Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast. On this episode, Fritz Coleman.
So I joined the Navy willingly, and suddenly his respect for me increased. I was no longer a son. I was kind of, he looked at me more on a level plane.
Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast. Conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Thank you so much for the support, whether you're watching on YouTube, IGTV, or DB&A TV, or listening on your favorite platform. Before we get to my conversation with Fritz Coleman, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. Nearly 2 years ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I can learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, patience, self-care, and understanding. Fritz Coleman was a mainstay in Southern California, spending nearly 40 years doing the weather on NBC4, in addition to his continuing his decades-long run as a stand-up comic. He's also the co-host of the Media Path Podcast. One of the things I didn't ask when we talked a couple of years ago, how did you get the nickname Fritz?
Well, I'm 50% German, 50% English, 50% German. And the German side of the family, all the men going back six or seven generations are called Frederick Coleman. And my grandfather called me Fritz, which means little Frederick in German, to distinguish me from my father, especially when he was mad. And it kind of stuck. And when I was a kid, I was traumatized because it was the dumbest name ever. I was the only person who, you know, people had parakeets and basset hounds named Fritz, but I'd never met another human named Fritz. And so I hated it. But then when I became an adult and I was in broadcasting, both radio and TV, it was different. And so then I got used to it and liked it.
How was that adjustment for you? Did you think about changing your name because you were so traumatized from it?
Well, I did. I changed my name when I was in radio. I had two names in radio. One was Bobby Walker because my top 40 program director had a whole list of names that apparently had tested well, you know, and Bobby Walker was one of them because it was very male sounding and macho and testosterone ridden. And so he changed my name to Bobby Walker, and that worked for 4 years. Then I went to Syracuse, New York to work at WHEN radio. And that's not true. I went to Buffalo and worked at WKBW, and I wanted to use my name Fritz Coleman on the air, but my boss said, nobody on my radio station is going to be called Fritz because you sound like a Nazi camp guard.
Oh, no.
So I want you to do some sort of a manipulation of the rest of your name. And since my name is J. Frederick Coleman, I called myself J. Fredericks.
Wow. Gee, so at what point were you finally able to just be Fritz already?
Yeah, when I went into TV, and then it didn't matter anymore. And then it was different, and it was kind of a hook.
Yeah.
You know, my name and my glasses were my only distinguishing characteristics.
How many lenses do you have? How many frames, I should say, do you have?
Well, I have the Fritz Coleman Eyewear Museum. I can't access it right now, but I have, back in the days when, you know, my boss wanted us to experiment with being outside the box, I had red ones and I had plaid ones and I had iridescent blue, and I have a whole bunch of, I can't get to them.
Either your frames or George Pinocchio's vests. Who has more of one of them?
Unbelievable. And I found out later that's a bulletproof vest that he wears.
You've got to be to last as long as you two have. You got to have bulletproof something, right?
Well, I'll tell you, I quite honestly think, and this has nothing to do with my career, but I just because of the way the business is changing, I don't know that there will be 40-year careers anymore. I feel, yeah. And the older I get, the more fortunate I realize I've been. I just don't know that those days will happen again.
How did that hit you when you were let go by NBC? Did you see it coming?
Yes, it was my decision. I had announced about 6 months earlier to my boss that I wanted to retire.
Okay.
I had to get some medical procedures done and a whole bunch of stuff. And it was just time. And quite honestly, you know, we were moving into it. Weather casting goes in eras. You have a beautiful woman in bathing suits doing the weather, and then you have guys writing backwards with a magic marker on the plexiglass screen. We went through that era, and we went through, you know, attractive people to it. And now we're in the era of you better know what you're talking about because of climate change. Suddenly, people are really paying attention about the weather. And since they're taking it so seriously, I have to take my chips off the table because I have a BS, but not in science, if you know what I mean. And so I spent 40 years of my career essentially being Vanna White with maps.
Yeah, right.
But now it's not that. It's, you know, for the rest of the week, it'll be the fires of hell. And how warm is it going to be? We don't know because the thermometer doesn't go that high. Back to you.
Right.
So it's a different era. And I just felt like it was time. I tell people, even if you love what you do, 40 years is long enough.
How do you feel like you survived all those different eras? I mean, it sounds like you were just you, you know, you weren't playing a character or anything like that. You were just you. How do you feel like you survived all of the different changes?
I call it the Dick Clark syndrome, where try to offend the least number of people possible. It's not that you're very special. It's just that you offend the smallest number of people and you're able to ride through the various empires. I think I counted and I've been through 13 general managers of Channel 4 since I was there 40 years. And we all go through a lot of management changes. But the one cachet we have, and you know this from broadcasting, the one chip we can play is familiarity with the audience.
Yes.
And the longer you have your job, the more you sort of become part of the ebb and flow of people's lives. I mean, for 40 years, I came on the news at the same time every day, 5:20, and you're part of the regularity of people's lives. And you can't put a dollar figure on that, but it really matters in making you valuable to the station. And so if you can just last, then you somehow gain this sort of invisible cachet of value to the station. Because people know who you are. They have a thing called a Q score.
Yeah.
And
how likable are
you? Yeah, how likable
right.
you are. But now anymore, it's not even likable. It's how much you are recognized.
Okay.
And the greatest thing, you remember Dr. George, the weatherman? Apparently, he had the highest Q score ever in the history of Southern California because people knew who he was. They didn't necessarily appreciate his weathercasting. It didn't matter. The fact that he was recognizable to a majority of the people gave him value. So it's all about that kind of stuff.
How close did you get, if at all, to going back to school to get your BS in meteorology?
I couldn't have done it.
I
went to summer school 3 years in a row for math in high school. I wouldn't have been able to do it. Yeah. If they insisted that I have the meteorology stamp in the lower corner, the American Meteorological Society seal of approval, I would have to bow out. I was so horrible at math. But again, as I said before, weather goes through these, you know, sort of these periods of what's in vogue and what isn't. When I got into it, our evening newscast at Channel 4 was kind of like the morning newscasts are now. They're very familiar. They're fun. Yes, we do the news, but it's also the family connection of everybody that works there. And we joke around with one another. And that's really why I was hired. I got hired out of the Comedy Store. That was my background. I was a stand-up comic. And my boss described my job as, I don't want you to be a real weatherman. I want you to be the palate cleanser between the tragedy and the sports. Perfect. It's me.
I can do that.
Yeah. Just, you know, just be a pleasant, unoffensive moment in the newscast where people can catch their breath.
You've always kept at least not even just a toe in the stand-up comedy waters, but like almost, you know, a full foot, maybe even 2 feet in those waters. Why?
I never stopped working, and I made that promise to myself when I took the job doing weather. And it really, because I was doing weather in L.A., I thought this could work to my benefit with my stand-up career. I didn't want to give it up.
Right.
But it would put me on TV and make me recognizable in the area where I have to be recognizable to succeed as a stand-up comic. So I never stopped working. Even when I was doing the 11 o'clock news, I would do 2 or 3 comedy sets a week at the Comedy Store, or the Improv, or the Ice House in Pasadena, and we'd go do 15, 20 minutes and come back and do the 11 o'clock news until traffic got so bad that I couldn't get anywhere fast enough, so then I had to stop doing that.
What is it about stand-up that really just, you know, kind of scratches that itch?
It's just always been something to give me the greatest satisfaction. I always just envied the comics on television, starting with Carson and, of course, Bob Hope. But the first time I saw a stand-up comic live, not on the Ed Sullivan Show, not on a late-night talk show, was George Carlin. I saw do a concert outside Philadelphia. And I had never seen a comic work long form before, doing an hour and a half monologue. And it's not an exaggeration to say it was a religious experience for me, because I couldn't believe that somebody could get on a stage and seemingly never having had these thoughts before. It took me a long time to realize these are bits that are worked on for years, but to make them sound off the cuff and matter of fact and do it for 90 minutes and convulse this audience, I thought was the greatest amount of power I'd ever seen a human being have over a group of people. It was like an evangelical minister who really knew how to work the crowd. And I don't know. I never thought I could do it professionally, but that was a moment that really changed my life. And then subconsciously, I always sort of worked toward that end and wanted to do it.
More nerves, first time on stage as a stand-up comic, period, or the first time you were on Carson?
Well, the Carson show is, that's your comedy bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I know you were there, what, 3 or 4 times before you actually got on stage?
I did a total of 8 times. I did with Johnny, Joan Rivers, Gary Shandling, and Jay Leno. And part of it was that my office was right over the Tonight Show at NBC on Olive and Alameda. And a couple of times they'd have a cancellation or there'd be a change in the schedule, and they say, do you have a new 6 minutes? And I would say yes, and the next day I'd be on the Tonight Show, which was the best way to do it, so you didn't have 2 weeks of pre-nerves worrying about it.
Right.
But those are nerves that you can't even describe. It's the biggest moment in the life of a comic of that era. It wouldn't matter as much now, but it's breathtaking. And the first time I did the Tonight Show, I got bumped twice before I finally got on.
Right, right.
And because the comic came on at 10 minutes after 12 between the headliner and maybe the music act. And if the headliner went long, the accordion was the middle act, which was the comic, and they blew me out. So by the time I got on, it was very beneficial to me because my nerves were quelled a little bit and I did a more relaxed performance when I finally made it on.
You talk about George Carlin. I can't help but wonder what kinds of observations he would have in the last 5 to 10 years. Richard Pryor, even.
Oh, yeah.
Would just love to see what, I mean, not an hour and a half even. Just give me, you know.
Yeah.
Give me a Netflix special.
Well, I don't know where Richard would be. Carlin would be even more irascible and angry. When he got toward the end of his career, and I think he holds the record for the number of HBO specials. He was very prolific. But his last several, he was very angry. And it wasn't even about humor. It was about venting. And I think, you know, having lived through the last 4 years, who knows, he'd be off the deep end by now. But what I loved about him was there was no greater wordsmith. He was just a brilliant analyzer of the way we communicate with one another. Everything he said was so beautifully studied and carefully parsed. And I'm with you. I would love to hear what he would have to say now. It wouldn't be pretty, I don't think.
No, I don't. I don't think so either. I think about, you know, all the years that you spent in broadcasting. You're alone in front of that green screen, but yes, you're part of a team. You know, people toss it to you, you toss it back. There's a couple seconds of banter or whatever, but you've got the Media Path podcast right now with Louise. What is it like working with a partner? How has the adjustment been for you? Because you started in radio and podcasting is just that.
Yeah.
It's just radio. How is
that? That's a really interesting question. I look at my path in my career, and I think it's all a continuation of the fact that I was an only child and sort of self-sustaining through life. I entertain myself. Then when I'm in radio, I'm in the booth by myself, as you know, for 4 hours. Yeah. And then stand up, you're alone on stage and you're totally responsible for how people react to you.
Yep.
And when you're doing the weather, when I would do the weather, you were responsible for preparing and presenting your own weathercast. I had no help. I had no meteorologist working with me or any production assistants. I did it all myself. My boss wouldn't know if I was at work until he saw me pop up on the air. That's totally self-contained. And so my podcast is, our podcast is, the first time I ever worked with a partner, and your observation is great, but I love it because Wheezy and I have been friends for a long time. She produced one of my one-person shows called The Reception, which I did for a couple of years all around the United States. And she started a radio company called Premier Radio Networks, which ultimately was sold to Clear Channel.
Oh, nothing, just a little radio network.
I'll tell you, quite honestly, she's one of the great success stories of anybody I've personally known. It's really a great story. And we've always been interested in the same thing, you know, comedy and music and the history of music and all types of music. And so it's an easy fit for me because I have found a person with common interests. If only I was this successful in marriage, I would be a lot better off. We're having a great, I'll give you an example. Tomorrow we're interviewing, you might know him because you're in the business, but there's an engineer, Bill Schneed. Do you know who Bill is?
The name sounds familiar.
Bill has 140 gold and platinum records from engineering hit songs.
Wow.
He engineered some of the Wrecking Crew stuff from the 70s and 80s in LA. He lives in Nashville now. He engineered Barbara Streisand albums, Three Dog Night, Ringo Starr, Carly Simon. He's got an astonishing career. And he has a book out with a great title called Chairman at the Board, which is fantastic.
I like that.
And anyway, so he's a music guy. You know, we've interviewed Bill Medley and Gary Puckett and all these great guys, and they're all sort of connected, everybody in the music business. So all that to answer your question in way too long a way, Wheezy and I have common interests, music being one of them, so we have a lot of fun talking to these people.
Take me back to your Navy days. What are some things that really kind of pop out memory-wise in the Navy?
Well, first of all, it introduced me to my career because I worked for Armed Forces Radio and Television for 3.5 years. You got to remember, this is the Vietnam War. And the reason I was in the military was because this was during the draft. And during that period of time, mid-60s to early 70s, if you dropped below a C average in college, you lost your college deferment. And I cleared that bar by a mile. So I was flunking out of college. I went to Salem College in Clarksburg, West Virginia, which was what I call part of the Ivy League for underachievers. It was a miracle I made it into college. And 60 days after I dropped below a C average, I got a letter from the Defense Department, come and get a physical. We're considering you for joining our group. So I went down for my physical. And while I was there, I just had an epiphany. I said, I don't mind serving my country. I would be proud to serve my country. I just think I would do it best in a non-gun-oriented way. If I didn't have to go shoot people, I would be of better service to my country.
I mean, we're talking 50 years ago. You're what, 95 pounds soaking wet?
Oh, exactly. But it didn't matter at those point. If you had a pulse, you were going to be in Da Nang in about 2 weeks. So I just picked up my clothes. I had socks on. That's all I had on. I picked up my clothes and I walked down this line of interviewers to the Navy desk. And I said, I want to enlist. And I enlisted. And to this day, it's the single best decision I've ever made. I was wandering around the planet, having no idea where my place was in life. I was wasting my parents' money. I had flunked out of college. And the Navy forced me to grow up. It forced me to think, again, I was an only child. It forced me to think outside of my own self-interest and join the WE group and, you know, do a team effort. And it introduced me to my career. They were looking for volunteers to go on this ship, the USS John F. Kennedy, and man their broadcast facilities. They had radio and television facilities on there. I said, I really want to do that. I always had a mild interest in DJing and all that kind of stuff. And I applied and I got accepted. So I did a radio show in the morning. I did newscasts. I did weather forecasts. At night, for entertaining the shipmates, I showed 16 millimeter kinescopes. It literally introduced me to my career during the Vietnam War.
Right.
So not only did I not have to go fight in the war, that would be the 7th Fleet in the Navy. I went to the 6th Fleet, which was the Mediterranean. So for 3.5 years, I got to see the most beautiful parts of the planet for free, avoid combat. I learned to ski in the Alps. I covered the Grand Prix at Monaco for Armed Forces Television. I had the most incredible experience of my life, when it could have gone the other way had I allowed myself to be drafted.
Right, right.
So all I can say to you is that the Navy was the single best decision of my life for many reasons.
What'd your parents, what was their reaction when you told them that you're enlisting?
I think they were glad. You know, after I enlisted in the Navy, my father's relationship with me completely changed.
Really?
Before that, I was a drag on his existence. Not a man that enjoyed being a father a lot. And, you know, I was costing him a lot of money. And so I joined the Navy willingly. And suddenly his respect for me increased. I was no longer a son. I was kind of, he looked at me more on a level plane, because he had spent a lot of his life. He was involved in politics and state government in Pennsylvania and was able to avoid service during World War II and very proud of that. But I had the guts to go in the Navy and not try to avoid it. So as soon as that happened, my relationship with my father completely changed. It was kind of cool. I didn't expect it to, but
like
it did.
Change for the long term, or
yes. Yes, he respected me. I had done something that he had tried to avoid. You know, I could have gone to Vietnam, but didn't. And he just respected that. He gave me credit as having grown up. And I never thought I'd get there, but I did. It was interesting.
So 40 years punching that clock at Channel 4 NBC in Los Angeles, you know, many years prior to that, Buffalo, different places. What was it like that first week after retirement where you're like, okay, this isn't just a week's vacation. I'm not going anywhere. This is it.
Yeah. That's a great question. I was really worried about retirement because I've been a workaholic all my life. As you know, Aaron, in broadcasting, you just have to keep treading water as fast as you can because you never know when there'll be somebody hot on your tail to take over your position. And it was just some hole in my character that needed to be filled. So I worked more than I needed to. And that 11 o'clock news is the greatest speed bump to a social life ever invented. Because, and I never got to see my children during pivotal times in their lives because I had to go back to work at 8:30 and didn't see my grandchildren for the first couple of years of their lives. So there were a lot of moments that I missed. So I was worried about how retirement would be. And I wasn't worried about any of those things. What I was worried about was watching my father retire. My father was, as I said, involved in some state politics, and he ended up being a vice president of sales of a national company that manufactured construction materials like cement and sand and stone and all these things. But he was a classic World War II, post-World War II American man, man of the Eisenhower era in the 50s, where his whole identity was his work.
Right, right.
He didn't read. He didn't go to movies. He didn't go to plays. He didn't give a damn. He cared about politics only because he was a dyed-in-the-wool conservative and didn't want to pay taxes. So he got involved when it was time to worry about his taxes.
Yeah.
So when he retired, I watched a slow implosion of the man. He just got smaller. And then when he got too old to do his yard work, which was his only physical exercise, mowing the grass and using the weed whacker, he just imploded. He'd watch Wheel of Fortune at night and go to bed. And his life just got small. And I looked at that and said, I'm praying that doesn't happen to me. Well, it hasn't. My life is broader than that. I love movies and reading, and I'm doing the podcast, and I'm on the board of directors of three nonprofit organizations that are very dear to my heart. I'm very busy, but I'm busy with things that fill my heart and things that I've always enjoyed doing, but my job kept getting in the way. So I'm having a great retirement. I don't miss the job one bit. Far more skilled and smarter people than I have taken over those jobs, and I'm happy to be retired.
What's next for you? I know we talked a couple of years ago. You were doing something at the Gary Marshall Theater. Mm-hmm. What's next for you? More stand-up shows? One-man shows?
Yeah, I'm doing stand-up. I'm getting a little old for the clubs. When you look at the average audience, it's 25 to 30-year-old couples trying to get laid. And I have nothing to say to these people. I have too much psychic pain from living a long life that I like to impart to people who will understand, people of my age group. So I'm doing a lot of stand-up, but mainly I'm doing dinner speaking and small theater performances and special events and just loving it. And finally, and I hope it stays this way with the Delta variant, who knows, but we're starting to get some bookings again, and fall going into next winter is starting to look pretty good for performances. So happy about that.
Fritz, it was good to catch up, my friend. Thank you so much.
Hey, I appreciate the chance. You're sounding good and looking good, and I'm happy to talk to you.
You can watch this episode on YouTube, IGTV, DBNA TV. Follow the Aaron Bender podcast on your favorite platforms and link to it at aaronbender.com. That's also where you can find all my social media. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, aaronbendermedia@gmail.com. Be well, and thanks for listening.